It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 399 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, it's the return of Gene Ha, the creative force behind a wonderful book called May that comes out from Lion Forge. He's got Volume 2 arriving in stores on September 25th, so I'm sure you're going to want to make sure your local shop has it in stock for you. We talk about what it was like to have other creators play in his sandbox, which happens twice in this volume, as well as what the future holds for May. We also discuss his recent visit to Dragon Con, as well as other projects he's working on, at least what he can tell us about them. He's got a lot of great things to say about the fans, conventions, and what the future holds, so I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Gene Ha, the creator of May, among other good things. And it's spelled M-A-E, just so people know for sure. And I talked with you once when Volume 1 was out, and now we got Volume 2. How you doing, Gene?
I'm doing okay. Sorry, just ate dinner, and I keep on having to clear my throat. So I'm going to make disgusting noises throughout the whole interview. Well, hopefully not.
Oh, it's not as disgusting as some have done, so that'll be all right. We'll be all right. Now, talk about the second volume of May. You and I talked about the first one a little bit, so I don't want to repeat a lot of the stuff we did, but I know we will inevitably. Why don't you tell people what May is about?
Okay. Well, let me just state first off that May Volume 2 is everything I had planned from the start. I kind of had very vague stuff after that, but this is all the big plot lines tied up, and larger story of May is about two sisters from rural Indiana. And at the start of the story, May has been taking care of her dad, has just graduated from high school, and her older sister has been missing for 8 years. And the story starts a little bit after when her sister comes back and claims she's been on another world fighting against mad scientists and monsters and leading barbarian warrior cats into battle, which to the very grounded, very practical May sounds just impossible to believe. And then the monsters follow her sister back. So this is how May gets dragged into the otherworldly adventures of her older sister, Abby. And the chaos keeps on building. And it comes to a big head. And you get to meet big bats and bigger big bats at the end of Volume 2. And giant plot twists I've been plotting forever. And just it was a huge, giant, just thrill ride for me to be able to write and draw all this. So. Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I don't want to spoil the surprise, but there is a great big surprise at the end of Volume 2.
Yeah.
Which was great. Something that, well, gosh, even I say anything is going to spoil it. But it was just a really good, I was surprised when we got to it. Let's just say that, because it was a really neat, it was something we haven't seen before. So I always love when somebody does that. There's an element that we're heading towards, and when we get there, it's, oh boy, that happened. So that's kind of where I was. So, of course, that's going to lead to Volume 3, apparently, so...
Okay, I'm trying to avoid spoilers, but I need to ask you, because I've been asking everybody, did you see it coming, and if you didn't see it coming, did it still make sense you read it?
It made perfect sense. I mean, you know, see, I can't spoil it, but let's just say the fact that the two girls are there, and there's something that they would like to have done that you know, comes true. So I like that. I mean, I didn't see it coming. I really didn't. Some people might have, but I didn't. And, you know, that made it all the more of a surprise when I turned the page and I went, whoa. So I liked that. That was very nice writing about that.
Yeah. It's so much fun. Just, it's, it, it's like throwing the perfect party. Just, but it takes years to get this done, essentially, just to tell a story like this. Mm-hmm. And just the drawing takes forever, and the coloring, and getting all the practical and publishing stuff done and deals. But it was just to get that part of the story done. And I have a lot more to tell. I'm going to take a hiatus before I tell it, mm-hmm. because then the big bad comes after this. Mm-hmm. And much bigger things than what you saw already happen. Mm. And it's going to be, it's a trick I learned from reading Alan Moore's Swamp Thing run, mm-hmm. where every time where I thought, wow, there is no way the story can get bigger than this. And then a few issues later, it got bigger.
It's going great. I mean, I'm really enjoying it. You know, we talked before about how much I liked female characters in Star Wars. Oh, before I get too much farther, though, I do want to talk about the fact that September 25th is the release date for the trade paperback in comic stores. And then it comes into regular stores. And I don't, people don't like the word regular anymore, but into other
old-fashioned bookstores.
Yeah. That's good. What day is that going to be?
October 1st.
October 1st. So not far away. So it'd be coming this week in bookstores, and then if you want to get somewhere else. Is it also going to be available digitally?
Yes. Okay. And in fact, the individual issues are available digitally, but it is nice to get the whole thing inside of one package. So if you can just wait a little bit and pick it up about a week from when we're recording, mm-hmm. yeah, you'll have it all nicely tied together with a little bit of bonus material at the end. Mm-hmm. There's one chapter was written by Mark Waid. There's an interview with him. Mm-hmm. And one chapter was written by Molly Jane Kramer of Doom Rocket. And then she wrote a bonus story where she gets to interview the character that was visually based on her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's surreal.
I've got to ask now, did you draw those bonus things? Like I read the bonus stuff was some of the most fun stuff to me. I really enjoyed. There's a bonus page where you're involved. You personally are involved in it, which I really enjoyed. I don't want to spoil it again because I think it'll lessen the fun if I start talking about it too much. But you get to talk to the fans.
Oh yeah,
as part of that. And did you draw that?
Yes, and yeah, I tend to be very self-effacing about this type of stuff, so it's like all excited about everyone else's stuff in my book. But yeah, there's a short thing where I talk directly to fans and talk about the experience of actually. Let me just say that. It's a little bit of a spoiler, but saying this, but I was very inspired by the early Jack Kirby and Stan Lee Fantastic Four stuff, mm-hmm. where the story is presented as reporting about true events by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, mm-hmm. about their friends, the Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of wanted to do a little side story like that.
It reminded me also of when the new Teen Titans came out, Perez and Wolfman would do those kinds of things. There'd be a little story where they'd talk. And I remember one when Perez is literally carrying Wolfman out the door saying, "Don't worry about it. I'll make it all work."
Yeah. One of my favorite things in the Fantastic Four run is that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby try to attend the wedding of Reed Richards and Sue Storm, mm-hmm. and they can't get in.
Well, this is kind of fun too because you have some guest stars, shall we say, with you there that I really enjoyed. That I love that page. I also love the interview. Did you draw that one between the writer and the character?
Oh yeah, and that was an experiment in style where it's when I say I'm going on hiatus, was offered two side projects. I can't even name the. Well, I can name the publishers. I mean, I'm doing one at Marvel and I'm something short at Marvel. I'm doing something longer at DC. Mm. And the DC thing, I'm going to create it in the style you see in the Molly Jane bonus story at the end of May Volume 2, but probably colored. Mm. And it's a duotone process where you have one layer that's the inks, that's black ink, and another layer that's a medium colored ink.
Mm.
And then I'm going to ask for a colorist to try to see what they can do with it and try to use the medium color as kind of like cell shading in anime. Where it's just very simple, two colors for every object, some of it in shadow, some of it in light, and seeing if they can make it work. And also, if I can get a colorist to do that, I'm doing a lot of tweaking on the colors I'm made to get it in my style and perfect, mm-hmm. To get it into my vision. Because my colorist, Wesley Hartman, a.k.a. Westflow, is brilliant, but nobody else paints in colors like I do. So he gives me a solid foundation, and I tweak it so it looks like my style. Mm-hmm. I think that if I hand this to Wesley, he'll be able to then more easily understand what I'm going for than if I just give black and white line art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you got to be careful with that because they want to be called color artists these days, colorists do. And there's a reason for that. I guess they want to feel like they've contributed something as an artist. And many colorists do.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wesley's very good about this. He came on board knowing that this is what I wanted. And he knows there's no way I could get this done without him. He is an important part of Team A.
It's just a wonderful story. I love the female characters. Now, one of the things that happens in this book, of course, you let people play in your sandbox, as you've already mentioned. What was that like for you? Because, I mean, Mark Waid's a great writer. There's no question about it. And the other writer is just a great writer, too. So you picked two of the best. But it still must have been nerve-wracking on some levels to let somebody else write.
You know, I think for most people it would be. But for me, I've spent all of my career working in collaborative, creative stuff. I mean, in high school, I was in improv. And, I mean, working in comics throughout all these years with great writers like Mark Waid, it's always been kind of this kind of tennis game of just bouncing ideas back and forth. So it was just, in a way, it was kind of like more like what I was used to. And if either of us had ego problems where we had stuff to prove and we were more territorial, I think it would have been difficult. But just so having so much fun working with each other, it was just a delight. It was just, I mean, Mark would throw an idea at me and I'd say, oh, that doesn't work inside of the universe of May because of the history of when the portals closed inside of 1910. Mm-hmm. And then I'd just throw some options at him and say, does any of these options work for you? And I would just go into this research frenzy trying to create options for Mark Waid to realize his vision. And then he'd say, oh, that one works. And then he ran with it and ran with many of my ideas and directions I would never have imagined.
That must have been fun to see because, you know, so many times writers, you know, I criticize people who only want to write their vision. They don't want to have anybody else because they're missing out on all the opportunities that somebody else and their perspective could present to you. And that sounds like that's what happened with you is you came across some stuff that you might not have thought of that expanded the story a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mark is so clever. I'll say this isn't a huge thing, but again, a small spoiler. But one of the things I've said in interviews before that I would never write is the scene where the geek girl is with a cute boy and the cute boy takes off her glasses and says, oh my God, you're beautiful. You're not a geek anymore. And the girl says, oh, thank God, I'm not a geek anymore. So I never got close to that. And Mark Waid, without me ever knowing that this is a thing I wasn't trying to write, just saw, oh, I see this gap where I know this geek girl fantasy of things they actually enjoy, but I know how to write it right. He took that idea, that pop culture idea I wouldn't touch, and he wrote it in a way where it actually does work for the character of May, where normally it's negating the geekiness of the character. And the essential character of May is that she's a hero because she's a geek. And he just made her more of a geek by the way he wrote it. It's just, you have to read it to understand it. It's just so smart. And it's something I would not have touched.
Well, you know, that's why you bring other people in so they can go places where you didn't expect to go. Yeah. So pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah. I enjoyed his story. You know, I don't want to spoil too much, but it is a story that geek girls can relate to.
Yeah.
I think very well.
Yeah. And I'm going to say also, it's kind of similar with Molly Jane's story where writing May has in a way taught me how much of a, using modern terminology, a cishet guy I am. And I can kind of understand, there's a certain level where on my gut, I don't understand women's sexual fantasies. I mean, I know I have friends, you know, who are cishet women themselves and stuff like that. So I know about it, but on a gut level, it's not the same thing for me where I don't look at a guy and kind of feel the same things. Or even don't look at a woman and feel the same things. And she was able to write to help me in two sections to kind of just get into the fantasy life of both Dahlia and May and what they want out of life and what they really don't want out of life and write it with an authenticity that I couldn't. Where this is the thing where there's a very famous panel where a women in comics panel I was in where they originally weren't planning on having women. And one of the arguments I had, we did bring on women, as soon as I noticed that that gap was there. But one of the reasons I brought up for why it's really important to have women writing women, or just people who've experienced anything write that experience themselves, is if you haven't lived it, you can hear from your friends or read a book about like what the experience is like, mm-hmm. and you can kind of ape the experience. You can copy it. But unless you've lived it, you cannot make new insights about it. Mm-hmm. You can't have authentic new insights about it. And the example I give for guys to help to understand this is like, haven't been in the military. So I can write about a character who's been in the military because I have friends who've served. Mm-hmm. But I'm never going to write anything where someone who served will say, oh yeah, you are expressing a truth that I've almost never seen inside of popular culture before. Because how would I? Mm-hmm. I just can't. And it's the same thing with like any experience like that beyond that. I will talk to people who served in the military, or I'll talk to women about their experiences, or people who from a foreign country, or an African-American friend about, you know, all these experiences I haven't had. And I can copy what they say to me and express it, but I can't dig into myself and express it that way.
Because I've interviewed many times like creators of color. How do you do a person of color? You know, I mean, what if you're a, you know, how does a black person write an Asian? But the how do you write something about a culture that you're not instinctively part of? And he said you research.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing to do. I think it's something to go and to get there. But I think you did a good thing, too, by bringing somebody who understands and knows those situations and can actually do it with authenticity. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't originally the plan. It's just that I visually based the character of Dahlia on my friend Molly Jane. And then it turned out that I definitely knew Dahlia was going to Purdue University. And then in conversation, just randomly a year after I first created the character, Molly Jane mentioned her experiences at Purdue. And it's like, what? You literally went to Purdue University. And then I began quizzing her about her experiences there to write one of the adventures of Dahlia at the school. And I realized after a while of talking to her, like, you kind of have the whole story in your head. I am just literally typing down everything you're saying and turning to a script. You should just write it yourself because I am just transcribing you. Mm-hmm. And she was reluctant at first, but, you know, I translated her story into the comics format and explained how comic scripts work. And she just knocked it out of the park. And she gave me insights I would never have been able to do myself without, frankly, just transcribing them from Molly Jane.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you got to ask after that, are you going to do more of that now that these have gone pretty successfully?
You know, I got to say, I'm not planning on it. But in truth, I wasn't planning on doing the Mark Waid thing, and I wasn't planning on doing the Molly Jane thing. The Mark Waid thing happened because he wanted me to work on a book, and I said, I'll draw your book for you if you write a story for me, because I just like working with him so much. I wouldn't pass up the opportunity. So it wasn't planned. It just happened. And then his project got canceled or mm-hmm. didn't happen for whatever reason. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But he was still willing to write a script for me. And I was like, I will not pass that up. And then again, with Molly Jane, I was planning on writing myself after doing my research. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I realized, no, she should write this story. This will be amazing if she writes a story. And she made a lot of creative decisions where I would not have made it. And then she made them work mm-hmm. in a way I wouldn't have expected.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, you know, that's the great thing about the creative process. You don't know where other people are going to go. And sometimes it adds just a little bit of a twist to it. Like, you know, you're writing, after a while, people might get familiar with it. And so to bring those two folks in to kind of go someplace different was kind of a nice turn, you know, when we turned a different corner than we might have with you. So that's pretty cool. It's great fun when you can do that and, you know, have us go different places, because I love going different places. That's a great thing.
I want to write a story about the Fortell family, about Abby and May Fortell. I have parents who have an interesting history, and I want to do a scene showing, like, you know, how they raised their kids, why they broke up and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The father is from the Czech Republic, what used to be called Czechoslovakia. And actually, if I ever met like someone from the Czech Republic, you know, an old man or woman who grew up during the communist times there, mm-hmm. and if I went through a Molly Jane experience of like, I'm just transcribing what you're describing to me. I mean, yeah, I would definitely let them write an issue if they were actually had writing chops and stuff like that, and they had a voice about that time. Otherwise, I'm going to have to really start interviewing old Czech people at some point in my writing process, mm-hmm. and just get nail down the details right.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah. Well, that's the thing to do. I mean, as because you both do both sides, you're the writer and the artist, and so it's great when people can do that. And I know I asked you about it before, but has doing like two volumes changed your perspective on it at all? Because you're a storyteller, is yeah. the way I remember it. Do you enjoy the writing more than you did the last time I talked with you, or what's kind of has anything in your perspective along those lines changed?
I guess I have a greater appreciation for the variety of readers at this point. And there's a style of reading comics where you read it as a prose novel with some little bonus illustrations in it. And you just read the word balloons and then glance at the image. You don't really look at the image, mm-hmm. which is a bit like watching your, you know, scrolling through your phone and social media while watching a movie mm-hmm. and listening to it and then looking up at the screen once in a while to see what's happening. In my heart, it's the wrong way to read a comic book. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's actually how a lot of people do it. And I don't want to totally invalidate their stuff, but you kind of have to write a little bit for those people too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to literally say like prose novelists who don't read comics a lot mm-hmm. can end up like this. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, well, this doesn't work as a novel. And it's like, it's not a novel, but you know, you kind of have to adapt for people like that. Mm-hmm. And if you get lucky, I just want to say before all my prose writer friends out there like attack me, I'm going to say one of the most brilliant, maybe the most brilliant visualist writers I ever worked with was Brad Meltzer, who's a novelist mm-hmm. first, who then jumped into comics. And he did the Eisner Award-winning issue of Justice League of America with me, mm-hmm. where he told me, please do the panels this way and make less and less panel as the pages go along so it feels more claustrophobic. And I responded, well, it kind of feels like I'm just being lazy. Why don't I just keep the panels large and then just get tighter and tighter close-ups? And he's like, trust me on this. And he was right. Mm. But by the end of the book, I'm going to say, frankly, I was doing like a third of the work I would normally do on a page because there was so much empty space between the panels. Mm. But also, it worked as storytelling. He was totally right. Some prose writers have great visual sense. Mm-hmm. Some don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because you say that because sometimes I'm just the opposite. If I am in a hurry or something, I'll skip some of the words and look at the images to get the story. You know, then I have to go back and read it, go back and read the word balloons and the other descriptions and stuff like that. But there are times I know when I've missed something and some of my friends, what did you think when he said that? He said that, did he? So you've got to be careful. Comic reading is a whole skill to itself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'll say, if you put this in movie terms, I have the director's bias, where I think of it as a visual, just I think film and comics are mainly visual storytelling forms. Mm-hmm. And the storytelling has to work mainly through that, with the words adding extra stuff that you can't do in the pictures. Mm-hmm. And so they complement each other. You try not to duplicate effort of like saying, I'm punching you, and then to show someone being punched and then having the guy respond, ow, I've been punched. This in a book by Eisner about how to do visual storytelling. This is kind of his example of like somebody shooting somebody and then a caption saying, and then a shot rang out. I'm shooting you, you dirty bastard. Blam. Arg, I've been shot. And that was the example of, do not do this. Mm-hmm. I've seen this so often. Do not do this. And then afterwards, when I saw it in comics, it was like, okay, yeah, that is exactly what Eisner says not to do. I try not to duplicate efforts in the words and the pictures, mm-hmm. but still I want the visuals to carry the story. Mm-hmm. But to some extent, you have to safeguard it a little bit for the people who are just reading the word balloons and then glancing at the pictures, mm-hmm. or vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I got to ask about this stuff. As far as like response, because I think one of the great things that's happening in comics, we're getting more women or female readers are coming on board. When I go to a comic store, the store where I go, the lady who runs the store, you know, she's the one that does all the ordering and stuff like that. And she understands both sides of the table, which I always enjoy talking with her because of that. But have you gotten response, because, you know, strong female characters, and you know how much I love that. But yeah. Have you gotten, like, female response, people come up to you and say, oh my gosh, you know, I love this book because of the way you've portrayed these women? Or have men come up and said that? How's it been for you when people talk about me?
I think I've definitely had that happen. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing is I try to make it a book that can be read by teenagers. Mm-hmm. And I try to have another level of sophistication where if you're really reading it as an adult, say an academic or something like that, or an adult 40-year-old comics grognard like me, I'm 50, by the way, a 50-year-old comics grognard like me, you can dig deeper into it and see more and start tying together the bits and pieces because we're all trying to win no prizes in our head. But I have the parents of young girls come up to me saying, my child is obsessed with this, but those kids don't usually go up to 50-year-old men saying, you know, trying to start conversations, and they shouldn't. I mean, in general, I mean, I'm happy to come to me, but just in general, yeah. But yeah, they see something in it, and they understand a message that I'm trying to get through it of just like, I'm trying to show a different vision of what a female hero can be like, because up until recently, there weren't a lot of female geek heroes out there who were heroes because they were geeky and who were the main character. They were usually supporting characters, or if they were the main character, geekiness was something they had to overcome to become a fully realized human being.
That's interesting. There's a character called Geek Girl that a friend of mine in the UK writes, and she was not a geek, but she ended up, she got glasses from somebody who was a super scientist, and now she's ended up going around, but, you know, she gets called Geek Girl, even though she's not really a geek, but there's a transformation going on. She's actually, because she's a superhero now, she kind of has to, you know, understand more of the stuff that she used to poo-poo, you know, before. So it's interesting to see that kind of stuff, but you're right, and it's usually the other way around is where I see them. I usually see people discovering geek stuff after not being very geeky at the start. So it's nice that you're going the other direction. I always like that. You know, what's one thing that I enjoy about the book is the perspective of that, because when I go to conventions, like I saw you at Dragon Con recently, and I see the girls going around in cosplay and stuff like that, I always look at them and kind of think, this must be kind of a great place for them to be, because they can put their geek on and be in a show it, you know, out loud and proud kind of stuff. And you can be those kinds of characters. And I often see women, well, just like guys too, everybody gets in character when they're dressed up like that. So they have kind of a, which of course I got to ask now, have you seen people cosplay as your characters?
Just a few. There's two sisters who, and they were very young when I first met them. They were probably like 10 and 12 or something like that. But I've stayed friends with them since. And they dressed up as Abby and May. And it wasn't like the expensive, I do this professionally type cosplaying, or like I'm a famous Instagram star. It was just one of them found a red yarn beret, and they found a jacket about the right color and stuff like that. And another one found a scarf that was kind of like May's. And it was just one of the most thrilling things ever. And then also my friend Drina Joe, who she wasn't at the time, but now she's an editor for Source Point Press, did a crazy good Abby costume where it's just like she had the jacket and the beret and the white pants. And oh, my God, it's just one of the biggest thrills of my life. Yeah, it's such an honor.
I remember when I told David Peterson, who does Mouse Guard, I saw him in New York, and while I was talking to him at the table, up comes two people dressed like two of his characters from Mouse Guard. And I said, I told him, I said, you know you have arrived when people start cosplaying your characters, I said to him. So it's the same thing with you. I mean, you know you've arrived when people look at the character and say, I want to be that character, even for just a little while.
Yeah, I'll say, I mean, my book Top 10 was pretty popular, and it's still, you know, beloved literally around the world, but I've only ever met one cosplayer for that.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a conversation I once had with Brian Azzarello where he said, don't you love it when someone comes up with and shows you their tattoos from your comic book? And I kind of like said, it's only happened to me once. And he's like, what? And he's like, that happens to me at every convention. It's like... So, yeah, if you have a tattoo of my artwork on you, please come up and show it to me, because then you will be the second person who's done that to me. Yeah, the first one was somebody who had my version of Thor's hammer from Top 10, which is way more elaborate than any of the Marvel versions.
Because I have to say, because I'm the editor on an indie comic by the name of Stabity Bunny, and one time we saw somebody was actually at a convention, and they took pictures of them actually getting a tattoo of that character on their arms.
Oh,
two of them did. And boy, you know, the creator was just like, whoa, wow, oh my gosh. You know, because then you know when things have, because that's a permanent thing. You're not going to get to take that off very easily. So
yeah.
When someone does that, they really like the character. So I kind of thought that's kind of fun. But see, your character's a little, your stories are a little different. You know, instead of like a plush rabbit, these are characters, and that makes it a little different as far as like relating to them and stuff.
Yeah. I got to say, okay, so I'm putting this out there right now. So especially for you, I've never said this to anyone else, literally anyone else. I'm definitely, obviously that means I've never said it on another podcast or interview for print or, you know, websites and stuff. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to this podcast and you want a tattoo from May, I will make you a really nice drawing of one of the characters. And I would advise that the character Kavito, the ringtail cat, mm-hmm. would make a really good tattoo.
Mm-hmm. That would be fun.
Yeah, I will just go to me a convention. If I have time, I will try to design a tattoo for you that will fit on whatever part of the body that you can show me without getting into trouble at a convention. I will just size it right so it'll fit there and look good on you. No one's done it yet.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll have to, next time I talk with you, we'll have to follow up and make sure that happens, because that'd be kind of fun to happen. Because, you know, comics are fun things because, you know, it's on some levels, it's a solitary experience. You sit and read it. It's just you. You can't have more than one person reading a comic at the same time because it's physically impossible.
Yeah.
But then when you get to take it with you away from the book and it becomes part of your life, it's kind of a neat thing. It's really something special when people do that, but it's tough too, you know. You don't want to get a tattoo of something. I mean, what if you decide you like this book and it crashes and burns? I mean, there are some books, yeah. I've read some that are just, you know, start out great and then all of a sudden a year later I go, ooh, what happened? You know?
Yeah.
But your book's not like that, thankfully.
Well, I mean, it's a bit like getting a celebrity tattooed on your arm or something like that, or a sports star or a musician or something like that. I mean, if they're still alive, who knows what they're going to do next or what you're going to find out about them next. But I don't think I have any dark, horrible secrets in my own life or in my plans for May that are just like there will be moral horrors. So, yeah, I will try to. I hope I will always be a creator you will not be embarrassed to read.
Well, of course, I got to ask you, as far as you mentioned a little bit what you're going to do in Volume 3. You're going to stick with the individual issue format, and then when you get them all out, put them together like this one was done?
I got to say, if I had the chance just to put it out as a book, I would do it, but publishers like putting out as individual chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of up to them, and I suspect they'll want to do it as single issues.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, man, it's funny because in the last, I thought I had everything plotted out perfectly, and then I made some realization, I had some inspiration in the last 2 months where it's like, oh, I have a way to upgrade that idea. Oh, and I have another way to upgrade that idea. And suddenly it's kind of like, I thought it was a gigantic story for Volume 3, and it just got bigger. I'll say it's still about the relationship between Abby and May mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're going through, it's always going to be focused on those characters and their emotional and social and everything battles that they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep on trying to kind of Jack Kirby Celestials it a little more and a little more and a little more. So it's kind of like I purposely started off the story very low key.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just not a lot of fantastical stuff, not a lot of things blowing up or gigantic objects and stuff like that. And I had plans where like I planned it was just like, I'm going to do something gigantic here,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm going to make it more gigantic here. And then when it gets to this point, it is going to be insanely gigantic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you've read to the end of Volume 2, and you know, mm-hmm. all these giant, huge cosmic things they were talking about early on in the story, mm-hmm. you get to see them at the end of Volume 3.
Mm.
Okay. And it gets bigger. Mm. I have my plans for my Alan Moore Swamp Thing. And then it turned out, yeah, the thing that was the size of a continent was just the thumbnail.
That sounds very Kirby-esque.
Yeah, it's Kirby filtered through Alan Moore and a few other people like that. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, Kirby, I'll say this to any young creator out there who, or even prose writer who's into science fiction and stuff like that, you cannot go wrong by getting inspiration from Kirby's biggest, craziest ideas. it's an endless resource, and more foreign creators are starting to take his ideas and realizing what a genius he was. And it's just like, as a kid, I wasn't a fan of Kirby.
Oh, really?
I thought he was kind of stiff and goofy, and then just as I got a little bit older and then a little bit older, I just like, at my public library as a kid, they had reprints of the 60s Marvel stuff, and I realized, oh man, I like the 60s stuff better than I do the 70s stuff I'm growing up with. I thought this was the best comics ever, but no, the 60s, the Kirby stuff in the 60s is really great, but his 70s stuff isn't as good. It's just like, it's too big and weird and cosmic and distant, and then it was just like, when I became a professional comic book artist, I realized, this is just pure genius. This is just pure, unfiltered genius. And you can never, you can keep on rereading it and seeing new things in it and realize all of my ideas in my head would be so much better if I just added a little shaving of Kirby to it. And I'm never going to be Jack Kirby. But oh God, just stealing his ideas, it makes everything taste better.
Oh, well, I have to tell you a funny little story. You know, Jack Kirby passed, and I happened to be in a comic store talking to the owner, you know, across the counter, you know, and in comes this young kid, about, I guess, 10 or 11. He walks in, and we're talking about stuff, of course, we're talking about, and he interrupts us and says, hey, some old guy died who used to draw comics, and he was no good anyway, but, you know, he wasn't drawing anything anymore. I think his name was, like, Kirby or something, and the guy from behind the counter jumped in front so I wouldn't kill him. Because, you know, I felt like saying, if you live long enough, you'll learn to appreciate this guy, because he's, you know, he just... you know, fries brains when, you know, when he would do stuff back in the 60s. I always used to love when he would do a device. He would have like a matter transfer magogram or whatever it was, and he'd have this device, and I'd look at it and say, yeah, that could do that. Because it's the way he did those kinds of things. It just looked so good the way he would do these elaborate devices that Reed Richards would hold in his hands, and, you know, some kind of cannon of some sort. You know, he's going to blast open a dimensional rift or something. And I'd be like, wow, that could do that.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool that you're going to get to do that and kind of that inspiration. Because, you know, I hope that'll always be the case, that people, even, you know, decades from now, will be able to look back and draw inspiration from Kirby. And maybe, you know, a couple of decades from now, look back and draw inspiration from your stuff, too.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I feel like there's like Will Eisner and Jack Kirby. And I kind of feel like almost every American creator after them is not going to be as groundbreakingly cosmic as the stuff Jack Kirby did, or as innovative in storytelling compared to what came before as Eisner was. So I'm never going to think that I'm going to be like, I don't think I'm ever going to imagine anybody's going to be the next Jack Kirby. But if I can help, if I can stand on his shoulder and, you know, and hold up, you know, and hold up a ray gun that looks like a video camera that turns people to stone or something like that, and just remind people of the greatness of what he's done. If I can hold a flashlight to Jack Kirby stuff and make people notice it, that is a big honor.
Well, cool. Well, you do a great job with it, I have to say. You know, the action sequences, you know, there's always two things in art that I have to look at: expressions on people's faces and action sequences. And I always find yours to be really superior in both of those categories. I can look at the face, and you're talking about, you don't necessarily have to have the word balloon to explain it. When you draw the face, I know what they're feeling, which is great. You know, not every artist can do that, I have to tell you. There's sometimes I'll look at it and I go, what is that they're thinking? But with your stuff, it's pretty clear, you know, what's going on. And then the action sequences too, the movements, it's all very fluid and very human, the way things go. So this is why, like, to me, May is a great joy to read, because I just, you know, the lady that I buy the comics from, she's constantly going, you're getting the next issue, it's coming soon, because she knows that I'm very excited about the book, and I like that. And I'm looking forward to, the reason I didn't get the trade from you at Dragon Con when you had them there was because I know she's ordered it for me, and I'm going to get it from her in the store before long. So I thought, I'll bring it next time I see you. Well, which begs the question, what other cons are you going to do this year?
You know, I made a mistake in scheduling. So I thought May was going to come out in the summer, but it turned out Lionforge scheduled it for the fall. But I only found out I scheduled my conventions last winter before this was all settled. So I did a lot of big conventions in the summer before May Volume 2 came out. And now that May Volume 2 is coming out, I already signed up to do a lot of small conventions and small events, or medium-sized events too. But I'm not doing the big conventions this autumn, so I'm not going to be at New York Comic Con. I'm not going to be at Baltimore. If you go to my page, you'll see. Actually, I'll go to it right now so I can make sure I get all the details right. I'm going to some great events. Let's see, doing some store signings and library cons in the Chicago area. So if you're in Chicago, come and see me. Green Bay, Wisconsin, of the famous Packers. Their local library is going to have me as the guest of honor at their comic convention. So they have me on the posters, and this is literally the choice I got offered afterwards. I could go to New York Comic Con that same weekend, but I'd have to withdraw from the library that promised to bring, that's been taking care of me and put me on the poster.
Can't do that.
Yeah, and then later, I got contacted, a friend who lives in Washington, D.C., got the State Department in contact with me saying, would you like to go to an Algerian comic convention? Yes. And then I saw, oh, well, yeah, but I can't go. The Library Con. Kids are expecting me at this Library Con. I am going to go there. okay. So anyway, I'm also going to Memphis Comic Expo in Tennessee, which is a great convention I've been to before. It's the same weekend as Baltimore, but it's a smaller but also a great convention. And then I'm going to Malta Comic Con in Europe.
Wow. Very cool. You're getting around. That's a great thing. I mean, the good news about going to other cons, and I can say this as somebody who works cons with an indie comic creator, you get to develop new audiences. You talk to new fans. You can attract people to your stuff. And new fans kind of spread the word once they become fans. So that's a good thing to go to other places like that. I think that's really great.
Yeah. Now I've got this pent-up desire to go to New York Comic Con and Baltimore Comic Con, so... It's a 95% chance I will do both of them next year.
Okay, because I'll be at New York this year. I didn't get to San Diego this year. I got to, we've been doing some of the smaller cons, too, around. So it's kind of fun to see. That's when I saw you at Dragon Con. You know, it was great to see you there. Because, do you go to that con every year?
This is my first time I've gone to Heroes Con, the first time I've gone to Dragon Con. I have not done a lot of Southern conventions.
Because this is our first time at Dragon Con, too. I came away very impressed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as I wrote a column about it. The one floor we were on, the Comic and Artist Alley floor, could have been a whole convention somewhere else, but it was just one floor on one of the buildings. And I was like, you know, I barely got to any of this stuff. There were three floors of vendors below us in this building, and that was only one building. So, I mean, I came away going, wow. I said, when I went to San Diego, the first thing I really felt was how great it must be to live in a town where it's like this all the time. People constantly walking around in costume down in downtown San Diego and stuff like that. You know, you get all that stuff. But I felt more like a city that was comic book city.
Yeah. Okay. Like, there's a thing where they call San Diego America's geek prom. But in a way, well, I mean, it kind of feels like a modern prom in the sense that they're going to do a weapons check and stuff like that before you go in and all that type of stuff. The security there is insane. The great volunteers, but it's about security and keeping things organized and making sure the companies who are there can make their announcements on time. So it's essentially you getting to attend a press junket. And you get a party, too, along the way, and you can kind of squeeze that in, but it's mainly there for the press junkets. Dragon Con is not like that at all. It is a giant student-run, and when I say student, I mean geek and fan, student-run prom, where the main thing is it's the party they want to throw for themselves. And I was woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning by a live band playing the Cranberries' Zombie and this crowd chanting, In my head. If you want to go to the greatest geek party I've ever seen in my life, go to Atlanta's Dragon Con. It's insane. You will have that party up until literally 5 in the morning every night. And then just parallel parties happening for comics people, cosplay people, Star Trek people, all these different people having these amazing parties. Science fiction writers and game writers having their separate parties. And then while you're hungover, if you're an adult, you can then come visit me and hopefully buy a wonderful book and all the other amazing artists in Artist Alley.
Because I was floored. I mean, I've been to New York, and I've been to Baltimore, and I've been to San Diego, but I've never been to a con that was like this. So I'm really high on it right now. I want to make sure we get back there next year. You might want to get back there, too, because I really enjoyed myself. I really did.
Oh, yeah. It's if you have a fantasy of Neil Gaiman writing a scene in The Sandman's Dreaming where it's the dream of the perfect Halloween party mm-hmm. with geeks, for geeks. That's Dragon Con.
Yeah, well, hopefully I'll get to see you there, or maybe somewhere else before that. Do you know what your schedule next year is? You're still figuring that out.
I've got a few. I don't think it's really going to hurt if I actually say some things, but just keep in mind these are provisional.
Okay.
Let me see. Okay, so, okay, going into my folder where I keep future travel plans and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So do not buy airplane tickets and non-refundable hotel rooms if you're only going to see me. But here's some of the other things that I'm planning on doing next year.
Okay.
The French publisher of Top 10, Urban Comics, mm-hmm. Says they'd like to bring me out to Angoulême.
Mm.
I was late registering for C2E2, so I'm on the wait list. But I was told that the combination of guests they'd like to have again and all that type of stuff means I have a decent chance of getting a table because somebody's not going to pay for their table, and that means a cancellation, so they have to fit someone else in.
Mm-hmm.
This is confirmed. Very small, very lit-friendly, indie-friendly convention in Denver, Colorado called DINK, D-I-N-K.
Mm. Okay.
I've applied for TCAF for the first time.
Hmm.
So, again, that's provisional.
Mm-hmm.
Confirmed, May 16th, 17th, I'm going to Comic-Con Revolution in the confusingly named Ontario, California, which is out in the Badlands east of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. What about WonderCon or San Diego or any of that stuff?
I went to San Diego this year, so I don't feel an urgent need to go next year. Okay. I might, but let me see. Oh, and then let me see. Oh, and also, yeah, I have a burning need now to go to New York Comic Con next year and Baltimore. So, yeah, I don't think it's as fruitful to do the same con multiple years in a row.
Okay.
Sometimes. I mean, I almost always try to do C2E2, except for this year where I forgot to register in time.
Right.
But otherwise, I generally don't do the same con over and over again. I try to do at least 1 year gap.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, it sounds like you've got great stuff. Do you know, I guess these projects are going to keep you busy for a little while. Do you know when we can expect the third volume of May to start up again? Any idea?
I'm afraid it's going to be kind of a wait. So hopefully in the first half of 2021.
Okay.
And I have it plotted out. And the two-page story with Molly Jane interviewing Dahlia mm-hmm. is a preview of how I'm going to be drawing it, which gets across the vision in my head more accurately than anything I've done before beyond just fully painting everything by hand in Photoshop.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's one of the faster ways to draw I've ever found using an iPad Pro.
Yeah.
So if any, here's another offer for Wayne's Comics podcast listeners. If you buy May Volume 2 and contact me about it, I will send you one of the Procreate files, a download link for one of the Procreate files,
mm-hmm.
so you can see how I constructed the duotone images.
Hmm. Okay. Very cool. All right. Well, it's good stuff, Gene. All I can say is I'm really enjoying May. The second volume I'm going to have, my store has ordered it for me, so I'll be glad to get it. And I'm going to keep my ear to the ground to find out what other projects you're working on. They'll probably make announcements.
Yeah.
Don't get in trouble, of course, you know.
Yeah. There are some big names leading the projects, so it's going to be bigger than a merely Gene Ha announcement. There's some pretty cool projects.
Okay, well, you know, a merely Gene Ha announcement gets my attention anyway, so I think that'll be great. So it's going to be great stuff. Gene, you're doing wonderful stuff as always, and I can't wait to get a hold of these things. The extras are wonderful. I got to throw that in there towards the end. If you've read the books, I got to tell you, you want to buy the Volume 2 compilation because the extras are great fun. So it's good stuff. So Gene, all I can say is keep it up, man. You're doing wonderful stuff. I love May, and I wish there was a TV show based on this someday.
I would be happy to let someone do that if they allow May to keep wearing her glasses. That's her visual symbol that she's a geek, just like a geek girl. Mm-hmm. And also, it would give me money to make more comics.
That's right. That's the point.
Yeah. You know the second oldest joke in comics, right?
Uh-uh.
How do you make a small fortune in the comics industry?
You invest a large fortune.
Yes.
that joke goes on almost every industry. Somebody would say, how do you make money on the internet? If you've got a $1 million website, how do you make money on the internet? You invest $2 million. So I've always got that's a great one. So that one, I actually misled you there. But once I heard the question, I said, okay, I remember this kind of joke. But it was great stuff, Gene. Always good to talk with you, man. And I look forward to seeing stuff and have fun overseas and you know, enjoy making new fans and stuff like that. It's going to be great fun.
Yeah, I have one of the greatest jobs in the world. I am so grateful to everyone out there who reads my books and lets me tell amazing stories, because you guys are the best. And all of those offers are real. Seriously, first person comes up and asks for a free tattoo design from May, come up to me at a convention or a signing, and I will try to design the right tattoo for you.
And then you got to send a picture, of course, once it's done.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Yeah, this is not just a free drawing. This is a tattoo you're doing and stuff. So, yeah, well, Gene, keep it up. I can tell you, you're doing great stuff. And all the tattoo people, get busy. It's time to get on and get a hold of Gene. You go to his website and find out where he's going to be. Or he could even email you, probably.
Oh, no. Website. I want to do this in person. I want to see their arm or whatever that they want to put the tattoo on, so I can design it so it fits them. And also, it's too easy to do it by email and then not do it.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, this is a real thing. So, yeah. All right. Well, we look forward to talking with you. You know, I got to find out which projects you're going to be working on, because now I'm anticipating how great those are going to be. And then we get back to May, which is, you know, another great book. So you're doing great stuff. I'm enjoying it. I'm glad that you're getting to do all of the stuff that you want to do and telling the stories you want to.
If you go to my Instagram right now, and I'm talking to Wayne right now, and not necessarily to the listeners. He can repost it on his website, a link to it. There's an image from the short story I was talking about on there, but I gave even less information to people on Instagram than I gave to Wayne, because I like blabbing and talking to people and chatting with geeks. So, but yeah, you can repost that image and say, I know more about this than anyone else on the internet does.
Well, this will be up coming real soon, so people will get the follow-up soon. So, well, you have a good time there, Gene. It's really good talking with you.
It's good talking to you, too.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week. Next time, episode 400, featuring an up-and-coming creator that you're going to want to pay attention to. But until then, keep reading your comics.